Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to UAP Studies Podcast. I am your host, Jason Gilmet, and your other host, Michael Glosson, joins us again from an undisclosed location in the United States. How are you doing, sir?
My bunker. I'm doing great. This is our third interview today. We're really knocking them out, so it won't be that way for the listeners, but we're really excited about this one. Christopher Noel is joining us from up in Vermont.
Up here in the snowy north where it was 10 degrees last night.
Oh, wow.
Man.
Probably that cold for you, Jason, but not for you, Michael.
No.
Not that I know where you are.
No, undisclosed here.
Undisclosed for Michael. Yeah, but being in the Fraser Valley, well, especially lower mainland in BC, like we have really nice weather. We get rain. That's it. But we don't get snow, right?
You're part of that temperate airflow out there on the
depressing. It's depressing because it's always raining. So, yeah, it's not snow. I'd rather be shoveling snow on a sunny day.
It's a trade-off.
Exactly. Yeah.
Not me. I'm so sick of snow. I lived with nothing but a wood stove for 20 years, and now I've upgraded a little. It's just a nightmare.
Not to mention, it's been rough.
Have you ever been to Bella Coola?
Bella Coola? It's in BC, right?
It's way northwest of Vancouver, about 80 miles.
No, I haven't been there yet.
Anyway, I went there looking for Sasquatch one time, but that's another story.
Another lifetime.
Did you find him?
No, but I found a lot of people who'd seen him, and it turned out to be an interview trip rather than a cryptozoology field research trip. And I was too scared to get out of the van, it turned out, because there are grizzly bears up there. I didn't think of that.
Yeah.
So I just stayed in town and interviewed people.
Yeah, bears scare the crap out of me. They'll eat you alive. That's the worst part.
They don't care.
Yeah. Like a lion will do the decency to choke you to death before he eats you, but the bear doesn't care. It's just going to chew and swallow. It's like, ugh.
The grizzlies are now mating with the polar bears, right? So you get pizzlies.
I've heard about that, right?
Yeah.
Even up here, when I sleep out by myself in Sasquatch territory, I get so scared that sometimes I wear like a cervical collar so that a mountain lion, we have catamounts here, mountain lions, and they'll just come and just take your neck off.
See, there's more than just UFOs and alien abductions to worry about. There's also the wildlife, right?
It's a wide array of anxiety producing realities in our world.
But it's humbling because
the other way.
It's humbling because, you know, you realize when you're up against a bear, even a cougar, just how not up the upper chain.
No.
You're not in the upper food chain at all here. We're just guns.
To say nothing of Sasquatch, which is 25 times stronger than you, you're up against things that are 5 times stronger than you, and might as well just resign yourself to your fate sometimes.
Exactly. So that's why I don't go out in nature. Just stay home where it's safe, kids.
That's our advice.
Yes, that's good advice. No, this is great. We're really thankful for you to join us today. I know I've reached out to you. I want to say LinkedIn at first, but I don't know where initially. And when I saw your book, which you graciously sent over to me, so it's called UAPs and the Afterlife, How New Disclosure Supports Centuries of Physics and Spiritual Research. Now, if you are watching this on YouTube or on Spotify, you'll see that I'm holding the book right now. We'll also add a link to the book in the episode description too for you to purchase it. I was just so you know, I was impressed because the book reminds me of the Jacques Vallée books. It's the same size, sort of same format. I really like that. And it's very well written. I'm not going to lie and say that I read the whole thing, but I've gone through some of the book already.
And say that I read the whole thing.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah,
every word of it.
Yeah, every word of it.
Including the appendices?
So as an academic, one of the first habits you get into, or one of the habits you get into with a book, is the first thing you look at is the indexes and appendices to see who else is mentioned and what other sort of like research and topics are being pulled in. So it's one of the first things that I read when I flip through a book.
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't go the whole 9 yards to do an index. That would have taken me another year.
Like Tolkien, you know, the appendices are almost as big as the Lord of the Rings. It's just like
mine are equally long as the main body of the book. But anyway, no one cares about that.
No, but it's very well written. And one of the aspects of that we've been at least trying to cover on the podcast, because we try to cover from all angles, is of course the consciousness, spirituality when it comes down to these crafts. It's something that for a long time I did not want to explore because I didn't think spirituality and whatever this phenomenon is was related. But as you know, being a researcher, whenever you have these biases, they end up stacking up and you're like, oh crap, now I got to go look into that too, because I can't toss it out, right?
I know. I always thought I would just stick with Sasquatch, not because otherwise I'd spread myself too thin, but you can't barricade these things off or like screen them off. They're too fluid. The whole situation is too fluid. And in order to be intellectually honest, you need to embrace more and more as you learn more and more, and try to put puzzle pieces together whenever possible to synthesize various different subsets of this large phenomenon that we're dealing with.
I like that, subsets. I like that because it is subcategories and whatever plethora encyclopedia that is ufology right now. And there's crossovers, like they cross over. There's experiences of, you know, ghosts amongst the UFOs or Sasquatch amongst UFOs or ghosts, like they seem to mix. And that's an aspect.
I find the more that I read about this subject, the more topics, I have books on my shelf now about, you know, the history of witchcraft and all sorts of things that I never would have thought had any really relevance to the subject, but I never thought that UAP would be relevant to my interests when I came to it. In the same sort of way. So it's kind of like if we had a whole infinite lifetime to read about everything, you know, you would eventually cover all the territory just kind of exploring the connections.
Right, exactly. Yeah, so I'm trying to do that I'm a rank newcomer to the UAP field. What I have is a background in spiritual and cryptozoological research that gives me a frame of reference that I don't think other UAP researchers generally have. For instance, I don't think most of them, I've never heard one of them mention a seance, for instance. Mm-hmm. And I found that when I went to my first seance led by a world-class medium last summer in Western New York State, the phenomena that I experienced, and actually it was two seances, and there were levitating objects. There were balls of light. There was objects appearing out of thin air. I got this aport. You know, aport is from the French to bring, and it means objects that appear. If I can, it's like a little stone. It might be a crystal or a gem. I've not tried to polish it yet, but it was given to me, believe it or not, folks, by a spirit hand. It wasn't connected to an arm and a body. I just put it in my hand, and things appear in seances, genuine seances, and have been for 175 years, and things disappear spontaneously, and things levitate, and I've experienced all of that, and it's like a microcosm of what folks experience in encountering UAPs and their occupants. You know, the grays are said to float around. And of course, the ships themselves hover without making any noise and without having any conventional propulsion system that we can understand. And neither do the objects that are levitating in association with physical mediums. Physical mediums is a term meaning mediums that don't just get information about people on the spirit side, but it actually engender physical phenomena, like things like I was mentioning. And they, most of them have been experiencing objects moving around and voices coming from midair, et cetera, since they were very young, and they develop and develop and develop. And then they try to spread the word by having seances with sitters who are fascinated enough to travel long distances and sit with them.
And how did you get interested in that?
Well, when I was 17, I had a ghost experience that kind of laid the foundation for my worldview the rest of my life. And now it's 45 years later. And
what happened with the ghost? Tell us.
Oh, you don't want to know. No, I'm kidding. So I
was going to say not fair.
Do you not? I don't know. It was a bad experience.
Sorry. No, I was a young lad, and I had a friend, a woman who was my writing teacher, who lived up the road in an old house. And she told me one day that her husband had been occasionally waking up in the middle of the night to see a tiny light come down from the ceiling and hover over my friend Catherine's head, just hover there and stay there for a while and then fade away. Also, they had seen she never saw those because she was asleep, but she and her husband and sometimes guests at the house would see a pillar of light in the corner, and it wouldn't have any distinguishing features when you looked at it, but when you thought about it later, everybody had the same picture in their mind of an old, sad-looking farmer with overalls kind of stooped over.
What? Oh, no, oh, I don't think I said anything. I just said,
Oh, okay. I thought you said when. This was 1978, if anyone cares. And so, and I said, being, you know, innocent and adventurous young soul, I said, let's try to contact it. And luckily she was game. So for the next 7.5 months, we had a protracted conversation with this conscious agent. His name was John Waite. And we talked to him through both Ouija board, which initially, many will relate to this, initially very inconclusive, and you're filled with skepticism. And then all of a sudden, boom, locks in. It's like, you can hardly keep up with it. And it would spell out words so fast that we ended up getting a cassette recorder. So we could just say the letters and later transcribe it all into a blank book. And we have like 500 questions and answers between us. So we did that, and we did automatic writing. My friend Catherine would put had an impulse to put the pen in her left hand, though she was right-handed, and wrote in a very curly, elegant script, utterly unlike her normal writing. And it would forward-slanting script, and it would say things. And the whole story is like half an hour long, so I do think you don't want me to tell the whole thing, but. Cutting to the chase, it turned out that he had killed his daughter, and he wanted us to, and therefore he was chained to this, to the earthly plane, and he was filled with remorse and a desire to somehow expiate this sin, you know? So he wanted us, he variously asked us to go dig up the kid. He said, dig dead kid for me. And he said, just where she was buried under this old elm tree down the field, across the field. And he said, I buried her by the fount of hell. And there's a spring down there. So he like was calling that the fount of hell. He was very poetic and terrifying sometimes.
Like Hannibal Lecter. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like that way before there was a Hannibal Lecter. And he said, and then at another point, he wanted Catherine and I to conceive a child to replace the one that he had killed. He said, Kate, he called her Kate. The Kate and Chris must love each other. Bear her again. Stuff like that. And he said, you must gather your harvest of bones. So suffice it to say that importantly, three things happened that were kind of physical mediumship, not just information spelled out or written. Sometimes there'd be sudden cold in the room, which is quite common, you know, and it would like be piercing in our bones. And he would say, I can't talk today. X is here. And so there's some negative blockage energy that went on. And also we would sit in the old part of the house to begin every session. And sometimes there'd be no connection, no sense of things. And then we'd hear a bell, like a cowbell ringing outside the wall. Toward this grove of pine trees where it seemed like he kind of hung out. And yet there was no bell in our reality outside that wall. And the kicker is that it was picked up on the cassette recorder. The third thing that happened was that one day I said, well, John, I'm about to go on a family vacation. So I'll see you in a couple of weeks. Bye. And as I turned to leave, I felt I think of it as a hand, but I didn't feel individual fingers, but I felt a caress across the back of my head, kind of like half dense, like halfway between nothing and a full hand. So that whole experience kind of set me up for a life.
Did you dig up his kid? I don't even know. You got to answer that question for me.
The cliffhanger. You know what? We never did, because we were chicken.
You're 17, right? So
I was 17. Yeah. I was going off to college. I didn't want to.
I don't think I would have opened up
a portal to evil any more than we already had. He was also very funny at times. It's all in the whole conversation. The whole dialogue is in my earlier book called "There Is No Veil," if anyone is interested. But so we didn't dig up that kid, and we didn't at the time look up to corroborate the information in the town records. But like 15 years later, one of us was talking. I was talking to our local town historian, and we mentioned this experience. And before we said anything about any details, she said, oh, that's the old Waite place, which is the last name that he gave us. So it all felt very overwhelmingly authentic. And so it gave me a worldview of, we live in a familiar frame, and there's a larger reality frame outside that. I really didn't have any other noteworthy paranormal experiences, except some things associated with Sasquatch, until just last summer when I went to these seances that I was mentioning. And so that's the ghost story in a nutshell.
Nice. And
go ahead.
I was going to say, with these seances, so I look at them almost very similar to the CE5, where people gather and they try to meditate together to make something manifest. And I think that's very similar.
You raise your collective vibration and sort of try to meet halfway the higher vibration that's coming, trying to lower itself toward you. And so you get to a sort of a liminal space where it can be fruitful, in terms of manifested, in terms of contact, where you are. It's not like talking to you guys normally. In some cases it can be, but it's like you get a tenuous connection, and it now and then it will spike toward something very obvious, like getting this stone, or having an object levitate and stay up near the ceiling for a long time. So it is like the CE5. It really is. It's an excellent analogy, and it's more than an analogy. It's substantively the same sort of thing. You know, I think that, to me, the entire situation that we're in can be summarized by the idea of frequency and density. I think that there's not a separate dimension that that ghosts and the visitors come from. I think it's all one place. We're in one universe, and we share this space right here. There are vibrations more than anyone could possibly count that aren't the ordinary vibrations, and they're filled with information. And, you know, from the mundane radio stations and Wi-Fi and all kinds of stuff, the richness of information that can be contained in vibrations and frequencies of matter and energy is very often not appreciated by people. And I think that the visitors and spirits exist at a higher vibration. That's what all the spirits say when they speak through mediums. And especially once they've gained enough credibility by having predicted the future, for instance, or giving if a medium has a sitter that's interested in learning about their loved one, medium will come out with information that sometimes only the sitter knew. And to prove that it's not just telepathy, they'll sometimes come out with information that neither the medium nor the sitter knows, but that when the sitter goes to investigate further, they find that it is true that Uncle Henry, you know, locked up the deed to the house in that cupboard that nobody's looked in, and nobody knew except Uncle Henry, who's dead. Stuff like that happens all the time in the annals of spiritualism. And so for a while now, I've been studying spiritualism, which is this movement of capitalizing on the fact that we can be in contact with those who have part of the physical body is. And it started in 1848, as most of you will know, listening to this, with the Fox sisters, who were not, contrary to popular belief, debunked later. Go into that if anybody's interested. But they started hearing raps, knocks on their walls and tables, and they found that they could get intelligent answers back and forth, conversations based on the alphabet with these knocks, or like two for no and one for yes or whatever. And that in Western New York spread, which ironically is where I had my seances, spread throughout America and throughout Europe over the next 100 years. And it, there's no end of extremely rigorously documented books about all the mediums and all the experiments, including by Nobel Prize winning scientists that occurred back in the day. There's a sort of a collective amnesia about all that because we live in such a materialistic zeitgeist or whatever you want to call it, that people just can't, you know, most people can't conceive of the fact that there is this higher vibration that exists, that co-located with us, not some far off heaven or something, but right here, that can, if the conscious agent is has enough will and capacity to do this, they can lower themselves and they can be in touch with us. They can touch a person on the back of the head. They can ring a bell. That's
the conscience agent. You mean being some sort of higher being or something, not us.
Higher vibration.
We are conscious
right.
agents.
We're conscious. Well, we're also spirit right now. You know, in a way you could say that we're already in the afterlife because we're a spirit living a physical life, you know, a brief physical life. And then we, according to every credible source of information I've been able to get, we go home, we go back home when we transcend these bodies. Anyway, there's so much to this that I could just go in all these directions, as you can tell, I can babble and babble. So you should try to keep me on track.
I do have questions. I'll say one of the things that comes, that constantly sort of nags at my mind over the past few years, as I've gotten interested in these things, is the use of the terms vibration and energy. Because on the one hand, I know that there are like sound theories of physics that account for all of reality by saying everything really is energy and information, and energy can be sort of summed up or described in terms of frequencies and vibrations and things, right? And that matter is a sort of collapsed waveform, and so everything really is
sort of vibration. Matter is kind of like an epiphenomenon of this vibration.
Yeah, of this sort of underlying energetic world. But on the other hand, I listen to people sometimes, and they use vibration and energy in a much more sort of like amorphous, ethereal kind of vague way, and I don't really know what they mean. They're not speaking in terms of physics, nor should they have to. I mean, I don't
right.
want to hold everybody to that level right. of rigor. But you're sort of venturing more into the actual, like, you're actually making claims about this, the kind of scientific underlying nature of reality and connecting it to literal vibration and energy and things like that in the scientific sense. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm trying to as much as possible because I shy away from things that seem too new agey. That's why I, you know, didn't go into studying UAPs for a while, because it just seemed like, oh, how can you actually, like Sasquatch, you can go out in the forest, you can find their structures, you can find their footprints, and then you can sleep there. Well, first this is just a parenthesis, so I'll make it quick, but first you put audio recorders out where you see their potential structures, and then if in the middle of the night you hear them walking around and knocking on trees and vocalizing, you say, okay, that's the part of their circuit, of their territory. You know, and then you sleep out there. If you grit your teeth and you know, get your shit together, you can go sleep out there, and they'll approach you. They'll push trees down 25 feet away from you. And I have all that in a documentary, if anybody's interested. It's called How to See a Sasquatch. Anyway,
I'm interested.
I got off track. Okay,
well, take a look. So with the Sasquatch thing, I know that there's sort of like roughly two camps, at least the way I divide people who are interested in Sasquatch related phenomena. There's sort of the pure like biological anthropology camp that says Sasquatch or Bigfoot would be interesting because it would be a hominid that's living out in the woods and that we don't know about and haven't documented.
And a close relative, to ours that would entirely rewrite the family tree.
Yeah, evolutionary history of humanity would be affected by this. That I understand that interest, and I don't find it totally implausible. I mean, people thought. I mean, the Western world thought that gorillas didn't exist. That they were
until 1902.
I think 1850 there was some rigorous documentation, but then it didn't become public consciousness. And I mean, we've barely 100 years into believing in gorillas, so that there might be and there are animals that exist in really small numbers, like clouded leopards. There's like less than 300 or something in there. So it's not crazy to me to think that there might be a few of these strange creatures living out in the woods. But then there's another camp that seems to go in a completely different direction. And like Sasquatch is like a spiritual, metaphysical entity of some totally different nature. It's not just an interesting biological evolutionary thing. Which of those camps do you fall into?
Well, luckily, I don't have to put my flag down in either one because I have my own.
You're a third camp. You're a rebel.
I have
okay.
a third yeah. camp that has very few members in it, and it's that I think that the Sasquatch flesh and blood and bone animal, like we're animals, can't just disappear like people say that they can. I think that just as our species can die and then some of us can manifest in visible form or palpable form, remember, I think that they are more psychically proficient or adept than we are. And I think they, after they die, can more easily change their vibration. I don't know why. I just think they're better at it than we are, just like they're better at telepathy. People have lots of times have mind speak between them and Sasquatch much more readily than they do with other of our own species. So I think that they're just advanced psychically, and I think that they can therefore materialize, manifest in ordinary reality more often. I think they can probably hang out with their still living community, you know, and friends. So I think that when people see them appearing and disappearing and think that that means that the entire species is spiritual, I think it is those that are no longer incarnate that people see coming and going, and that the flesh and blood subjects are still like us. They're still incarnated, but they're more conversant with frequency modulation than we are. That's my little hunch. This is my little hunch, my pet theory.
So they don't like, they're not just animals in your view that are living out in the woods like any other animal and breeding and stuff. They have some other sort of metaphysical plane of existence, and they occasionally visit this one?
No, as I say, the flesh and blood ones are flesh and blood ones.
Okay,
the,
but the
ones
the other
who died can come back more readily than we can, is what I think.
And I understand now.
So they're no different than we are, you know, in kind. They're different in degree, in the sense that they can have a higher degree of sort of translatability between frequency levels. So I think that, but, you know, so we're spirits and they're spirits, and so is a dog. People see their dead dogs come back sometimes, you know. So they're it's widely distributed kind of gift, the gift of being a spirit.
And I was going to say psyche is the word soul.
Yeah, exactly.
And when somebody says psychic, they mean that their soul is awakened to what's around them, sees things or pays attention to stuff other people are not.
Yeah, and now, in my book, I don't distinguish. I say psychic/spiritual research all the time because I think of them, like you're saying, under the same umbrella.
Yeah, and I was going to say a lot of intelligent people, and I think back maybe, you know, in that late 1800s, early 1900s, guys like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who was brilliant, you know, he came up with, you know, basically the modern science that we got today for detective work and
he was
CSI
no slouch.
And all that.
He was no slouch in terms of assessing evidence and coming to conclusions. So
he even saved the guy from he even saved the guy in real life from being hung, saying that he didn't do the crime, and he proved it. But he became very interested in the occult nearing the end of his career. After he was done writing Sherlock, he really got involved in that. And a lot of people like him, you know, Mark Twain and, you know, stuff like that, sort of like the occult. They always, there was a fascination there. And there seems to be that fascination within the intellect circuit, that there's something about the occult that is either real or, I mean, we're all fascinated by the occult in some way, but some people, you know, especially rich people, they could collect things. They look after specific things that is of interest to them. Do you think it's built into us, Christopher, that we're prone to either believe in things, like for me it would be UAPs, aliens, you know, Sasquatch, whatever. We prone or wired that way because we're right-brained as opposed to somebody who's left-brained, because somebody's left-brained wouldn't talk loosely the way we talk. They would be very reserved and all that doesn't fit. So they wouldn't say certain things. You're right brain. I figured you're artistic. You write. So is that something that's innate to right brain people?
Maybe. I don't really think in terms of right and left. I know a lot of people do. I think there's more of a holism going on. And I think that it's a matter of just a sort of a intrinsic curiosity. And I don't know where you would locate that in the brain, but I've always been curious about these things. So I pursue them. You know, nothing's more annoying to me anyway than somebody says, oh, I'm really interested in Sasquatch. And then you start talking to him and you get to like right below the surface, you start getting into more granular detail about how to research them and what we know about them, and their eyes glaze over because they're not truly interested. You know, they're like, well, you said you were interested. I think they're turned on by the idea of something like that, but they don't
really. The idea is interesting to them.
Yeah. They don't want to get into the nitty gritty of it. Same with spiritual, psychic spiritual research, and same with many people with UFOs, although that's becoming more of a widespread fascination with the disclosures of the recent years. But
let me tell you would hate being a philosopher because this is the experience of being a philosopher. People say, it's not to shit on people, like people have lives and jobs and things.
Yeah, they don't have to care about this, but don't pretend to care if you're not interested.
Yeah.
I know.
So you get into spiritualism. That's an interest of yours. And spiritualism in the like technical sense of like there was this movement that started in the 1840s, 50s that became like kind
widespread.
Of ground mediumship and seances and Ouija boards and all those things kind of grow out of it in America. And we sort of inherited it a bit from England. There was a similar resurgence at the same time of interest in spiritual work. You get interested in that, you go to seances, and you experience these phenomena that seem to you relevant to like the UAP question, or you actually experience UAP, or how does that connection really take life?
I have never experienced a UAP. That's why I'm kind of have an imposter syndrome, sort of stumbled into this field off the street, as it were. But my only contribution is that I unlike most well-known and UFO UAP researchers with a long track record, I have this background in spiritual awareness and what sorts of phenomena are possible without having to take recourse to technology. You know, like when we see an object levitate in a seance, or when a contactee reports seeing grays floating through their bedroom and then taking them by the hand, and then they float, and they actually float through the walls or through the ceiling. Nobody asks them, well, what was the propulsion system? You know, why? It's because consciousness is the driving force behind making an object, changing the object's constitution so that it becomes lighter than air. And I have a whole theory in the book, as you may have seen, about how that happens and how buoyancy is really what it is, rather than some sort of, it's definitely not electromagnetic force that picks up a table or, you know, a person.
And it's not because, flight. There's nothing actually pushing it or whatever.
Yeah, it's just that the object is changing its characteristics so that it's lighter than air. And I can go into that if you want. But But outside of the context in which these consciousness-driven phenomena occur, technologically minded UAP researchers and engineers and aeronautics experts have been for the last 75 years since Roswell, at least, if not before, striving to figure out what the propulsion system is. You know, is it this warp drive where you create a bubble or an envelope of a different gravitational field from the external field, so that you're always falling, whether to the outsider it would look like you're going up, to you you're falling toward the gravitational pull that you've created, sort of separately, you know, independently. But if that, or is it some sort of electromagnetic engines that can nullify the force of gravity? And people have been working on anti-gravity technology for many, many decades. But the trouble is that all of these, like Jack Sarfati or Salvatore Pais and others talk about, would require.
So you mentioned Jack Sarfati, and
he's kind of a kook, but he's. He's a well-respected physicist, at least he was. I don't really know his story.
When I started, just a quick, you know, bit on Jack Sarfati, when I got interested in this, somehow I don't know what exactly I did to deserve the plague of his attention, but he put me on an email list there's like 80 something people on this email list, and all of them except me are like famous people. And he will just email his sort of garbled string of consciousness thoughts about physics to all of us. And if you email him back and say, please take me off this list, he just won't do it. And matter of fact, I sent an email saying, please take me off this list. And he has it set up so that anything you send him gets forwarded to everybody else on the list. You don't have to hit reply all. So I got like emails back from lots of very well-known people who were like, you're never going to get off this list. You have to literally get a new fucking email address.
Dick, oh, you're kidding.
Yeah, no, yeah. So you mentioned Jack Sarfati, and instantly I feel like I'm about to have a seizure of it. I'm mad again about this. But okay, so you're right. Jack Sarfati.
But be that as it may.
There are people who know physics and they have good ideas about how these drives, these exotic propulsion systems might work. But you're saying you don't think that's it.
Saying is that all of these possibilities implicate a massive amount of energy. And energy, according to the first law of thermodynamics, is conserved. And so if you see something moving at 12,000 miles an hour, it takes a right turn. That's going to create a tremendous amount of heat. But fascinatingly, many times, not always, but at least half the time when people take a thermal camera to these objects, including the GoFast and the Tic Tac, they're cold. They're cold. And that, to me, when I realized that, it created a synapse between that realm and spiritual stuff. You know, in haunted houses, there's cold. In the conversation I mentioned with my ghost, we would get cold in the room. And I think that's because spirit matter, I don't think spirit is not matter. I think it's a different kind of matter at a higher vibration. And it's much less dense than this stuff that we're living in right now. And when spirit matter kind of profuses itself into like a room, I think that the kinetic energy reduces because all the molecules get farther apart. I'm sure that the air pressure falls, but people don't seem to take barometers into these situations. I want to, or I think that ghost hunters ought to add that to their kit, altimeters or barometers. But I think that cold and I think that the air pressure differential is what often is responsible for doors slamming from one room to the next. Mm-hmm. And so there's this higher vibration when it increases its ratio. It's always here. There's always spirit stuff around here. Otherwise, if I died right this moment, my spirit wouldn't be able to suddenly be like aspirated out of my body. Yeah. So it's always around us. It's the water we swim in addition to the ordinary matter water that we swim in. But the ratio of it gets higher and higher. the sort of farther from ordinary matter we get, I guess, upward, which is why spirits go up. And I think when it comes down, if there's a visitation or a haunting, or you summon a conscious agent who's transcended this plane and they come down, often there's cold, and often people have headaches, which is like what you have on an airplane when you go up in altitude, or they have symptoms, like ghost hunters often come down with symptoms like altitude sickness. Like if you suddenly go from sea level to 25,000 feet, well, not quite that high because you would have no oxygen, but like 10,000 feet, you're going to get a headache in your sinuses. All the pressure is going to be not equalized.
Oh, yeah. I've wondered this before when people talk about coldness in a room, if there are some, if there are entities that have to act in some sort of way, maybe they would have to sort of borrow energy from, they're borrowing the thermodynamic sort of level of energy in order to move a Ouija board or whatever the hell it is.
That's a very common theory, and it might very well be true. I think that they have enough energy in and of themselves to do what they need to do. So to me, either could be true or neither could be true, obviously, with any of this stuff. But to me, it's more likely that they, when they, in a room or a certain cubic area of space becomes inspirited, it becomes less dense in general. And I think that heat is just a function of kinetic energy and the closeness of molecules and the movement of molecules. So if a less dense medium suddenly infuses itself into a more dense medium, I think you're going to feel cold. And anyway, the only reason for going into that is that it seems to be connected to what people describe with UAPs. There's a documentary called A Tear in the Sky. And at one point, this guy is taking thermal footage of a high altitude UAP, and he says that it reads 80 degrees below zero.
Oh, wow.
And that doesn't comport with any of the propulsion systems that people are proposing, because it
there's this no guy heat. Can't, it's create opposite, no heat. Yeah. Opposite there's of no, heat. Yeah.
The opposite of heat. There's no, what do you call it? Energy profile or signature. That's what they call it, energy signature. So neither is there when an object in the seances actually usually becomes colder when an object levitates, which goes together with all this. And so what was I going to say? I forget.
So, but I was going to ask you, Christopher, just because we were talking to Ellie Flippin earlier for part two. It was on her uncle is Ingo Swann.
Right. Good for you.
Yeah. And, he was able to remote view. He saw some entities on this planet, five different locations that are not human, but they're here. There's rumors he even saw things behind the moon, but either way, he knows he saw something. I'm always fascinated by the fact that they always knew when he was there. Like they picked up on the fact that he was remote viewing them. They all turned to where he was. That scares the crap out of me. I asked her, like, is it that we are maybe on a lesser frequency? And this is my question to you. Are we operating on a lesser frequency? Is it that we've done it to ourselves, or is something else doing it to us to keep us there?
I think when we incarnate into this, into a life on Earth, we just, the nature of it is that we're in this dense plane. I think the Earth and object matter, ordinary matter, not this invisible kind of matter that I was talking about, which I think incidentally is what they call dark matter, but we can get into that. It's just the nature of the beast down here. It's denser. I don't think anything's forcing us. I think if you believe in reincarnation, as I do, you can choose to have a life that teaches you something. People say they choose the life and they can see ahead of time what they're going to sign up for, which is sort of mind boggling, but it may be the case in some cases. And you agree to go down here into this dense and sucky and difficult and laborious kind of existence in order to grow and learn, both morally and intellectually, and I guess other ways, perhaps. And so I don't think anyone's forcing you to come down here. It's just dense. When spirits come down, they often talk about how difficult it is to change their density to this extent that we can then be in what's the word? We can sense them, you know, in whatever way. And one of them said it's like putting on an overcoat and crawling out of a swimming pool when they come
heavy.
Down.
Yeah, that.
Yeah,
heaviness.
And some of them, I found that some mediums say that you can't contact just anyone. They have to be gifted on their side, just like a medium is gifted on our side, or else.
Oh,
they,
interesting.
There are mediums called controls on the other side. I don't like to call it sides because I don't think there is a veil. As I said, I think it's just a smooth transition of frequencies. But there are controls on the higher frequency that serve the same purpose as mediums do down here. They're just gifted at vibrational fluency or vibrational flexibility, you can say. And so lots of times, you know, I can't be in touch with my fiance who died 30 years ago, though I wish I could. It doesn't seem that she's good at it, or I'm not good at it, but I have been in touch with her through a friend who's a medium, a psychic medium. And so I think that's the way it is. Do you know, have you seen the Soul Foundation videos yet?
I've seen a few of them. Have you seen any of them, Michael?
I haven't seen them from this year. What about what?
The Soul Foundation is a conference that just happened for the first time last November, and it took them a while.
Gary Nolan's
Foundation. Yeah, Gary Nolan and his colleague at Stanford set it up, and David Grush is part of the founding member of this also, and it's to interdisciplinarily bring together people from different angles of academic expertise to kind of cross-fertilize with each other, cross-pollinate. And one of them is from the University of Albany. His last name is Knuth, Knuth. I'm forgetting.
Kevin Knuth.
So I recommend watching that lecture at least, that talk, because he talks about this energy thing and how baffling it is that the Tic Tac, for instance, went from 80,000 feet down to 50 feet in 0.87 of a second. He said, at the minimum, that would be 5,000 G-forces when it stopped, you know, and that would dump out. He has some outrageous, right at the moment when it stopped, it would be expected to dump, I forget the word, as much energy as all of the nuclear power stations in our country in that one moment, and yet it's cold. So I think it's a matter of varying the density. I think perhaps that when these craft are high up in the sky, and sometimes we can't even get a radar lock on them, people just see them. I think they're perhaps half dense by that point. We can see them barely, but then the closer they get down here, the more, by necessity, by definition, they densify, just like an airport in a seance. And then if they crash, they stay, you know, they stay dense, and we can take them off to Lockheed Martin or whatever and try to reverse engineer them, as apparently we've been doing. I guess we sometimes shoot them down with electromagnetic.
Sounds like we're doing that quite a bit, actually. Yeah,
it does sound like that. It does. Yeah. And so I think when people, I've got so much to say, I'm sorry, I keep skipping around, but when abductees, as quoted in John Mack's Passport to the Cosmos, when they talk about the experience of being transferred from their normal reality into this other space, they feel like they're becoming less dense. They say the grays, the visitors, are very undense, and that when they touch them, which is why they're floating around, when they touch the abductee in the middle of the night and they start floating, they feel like, one of them says, I felt like I was being disassembled cell by cell by cell, which is why they can then go through the wall or through the ceiling, or people in the car can just be drawn out of their cars and returned some hours later without realizing what happened. I think that we just become less dense. I think it's very, to me, it's a simple thing that people don't usually talk about. It's this frequency.
Christopher, can I?
Well, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, we're going to fight over this. One thing I found out is that they cannot float you out of a wall that has an electrical outlet. They will choose a window or door. Some people say they'll even go through the bathroom and then out the window through the bathroom, because that's the only place there's no electrical outlet.
Thank you for that. I hadn't heard that.
That's I found that out early on. I was like, wow, that's really cool. They can't take you through a wall where there's an electrical outlet. Somehow that impedes the process.
The electromagnetic spectrum is fundamental. Without it, there would be no matter, because it's what holds together matter. And I think when they come down from their native frequency, they by necessity, they cross through the frequencies that are electromagnetic spectrum. So I think that they can clash. Spirits can use that, can engage with electrons by, making a ghost box respond. I mean, those things are often really sensationalized, but they can work. Or like people will get phone calls from the dead. There's a book called Phone Calls from the Dead. I think that the smart ones, again, gifted ones, not your normal spirit, but a particularly gifted one, can, just like we can use a telephone without understanding how it works, just by a goal-oriented application of our intent, they can too. They don't have to go inside the phone and figure out exactly, they can.
It's like using your body. Like, I cannot explain to you how I will my arm to raise or something,
exactly.
But I can do it. The more you think about it, the worse you are at it. I wanted to interject that I think when we try to use scientific language, there's this problem that if you ever want to describe reality in a perfectly rigorous scientific way, you eventually just have to use pure math, right? There's always some degree of metaphor and analogy that we're using whenever we talk. And so when you talk about density, there's a part of my brain that's like, well, it can't be density in the normal sense that we use the term, because if I became less dense, like all the atoms, in my molecules, my body would have to spread out from each other and it would just kill me and my organs would come apart or something.
That's an excellent question. Go ahead. Finish up.
But there are other sort of entangled notions of density. Maybe you could explain it in terms of all the fundamental particles in your body stop interacting with the Higgs field in the same way that they normally would. And the Higgs field is theoretically what gives mass to every particles. But the theory is that they could exist in some sort of massless state if they weren't interacting with Higgs, using the, sort of through the Higgs boson. And it's kind of back and forth action. But that's not density in the way that we think of how the density of a sponge, decreasing as it sort of expands or something. But I don't think we need to get all caught up on that sort of language, because if we ever really wanted to be super rigorous about explaining all this scientifically, we would have to just go down to the mathematical level. And none of us, I don't understand math nearly well enough. And apparently understanding it well enough makes you, Jack Sarfati and you're a total asshole. Nobody wants to anyway. So
you're gonna hear from Sephardi's people.
It's the thing is, I already hear from this. I'm already get infinite emails from the
dude.
I have an answer.
Go for it.
We don't have to just throw up our hands because it's going to be math anyway. It has to work kind of logically first to me, and then the math can fill in all the gaps. But there is so much empty space. Now, I know you know this too. In any given, piece of matter, like this stone is 99.9999% empty space. And I heard statistics that if you took out all the empty space from all 8.2 billion of us on Earth, what remained would fit inside a snow globe. So there's plenty of room inside of an object, a material object, for an infusion of this low density spirit matter, consciousness matter, to go in there in a table, say, and make it lighter than air. I don't think you have to use a sponge analogy. I don't think it has to expand beyond its original proportions. I think you just change the ratio inside it.
Sure. But then you are using a slightly different sense of the term density than we normally think of. Like all the molecules of the table are still there in the same position, but they're very
But the overall lower density, they're still there, but instead of but some of the empty space has now been taken up by something that's even more even less dense than the space was to begin with, because this dark matter in the book you might have seen I have this way of explaining this kind of analogy to explain just how rarefied this stuff must be in order to achieve the effect that it achieves on the galactic level. I'm not being very articulate, but by the way, though, if anyone, I know I've been talking about things levitating. I have two pieces that I want to give to you. One is a quotation by Leslie Keen. You know her for being at the forefront of taking the of blowing the lid off the UAP cover up with her 2017 New York Times article, and she also wrote a groundbreaking UFO book. And she's quoted, and she also so why I bring
she's
her
been
up,
on the show actually.
Before, oh, good for you.
My time here, but yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Good. Why I bring her up is that she also is a weekly member of a very very long-standing and genuine seance with this physical medium named Stuart Alexander, and she's seen all the same things that I saw. I just got glimpses of the things that she's seen time and time again, and she says in an interview, quote, "When you can sit in a room and watch objects levitate before your eyes, which I've done many times, and so have many others, that's got to be, there's got to be a physics, a scientific explanation for what is going on to make that happen. And I wish that more scientists were curious about this. This is actually happening." So the second piece I wanted to tell you is that if you want to see some videos of objects levitating, as I know you do, I have a video that includes some clips of that, and it's on YouTube, and it's called Anti-Gravity Without Technology. And I think that if you just search that, you'll get to it. But if that doesn't work, my YouTube channel that it's on is called Impossible Visits.
Well, we will definitely link to it in the show notes for anybody who's
Great.
Listening.
Great.
Yeah. The subject for me is very fascinating because I've been, you know, at night I suffer from insomnia, so I watch near death experience.
I watch so many of those.
Oh,
I watch them.
Dude, I'm so
oh my
addicted.
God, I can't get enough of them.
But you're right. Like people always mention, you know, even I was watching Leslie's documentary. You know, a bunch of kids that say, "I miss my old mummy," and like, "What are you talking about?" And my mummy was here. We lived there. Like the kid knows.
Oh my God. Yeah. Like, sometimes you can go and confirm point by point by point everything the kid said.
Like everything crazy. Confirmed. It's crazy. Yeah. The name, the dates. I was murdered by my nanny. Like they know exactly how it ended. It's nuts.
Right.
But I'm trying to reconcile, okay, you know, you hear about this great entity, God, if you will, the great consciousness that sort of gives you your life review. And I'm trying to fit that, like, okay, well, what? How does that fit in with either extra-dimensional or extraterrestrials, the UFOs that we have? So I know now it's starting to come out more and more that these things are interested in the fact that we harbor souls. Maybe they don't harbor souls. Maybe they have an interest in that. Are they shepherds? Are they there to just like they're overseers, make sure everything's going smoothly according to plan? Like, do you have any theories? I know you're kind of early on in, you know, the UAPs, but you kind of have a theory as to what their role in all of this could be.
My pet theory so far, my current thinking is that they don't have the ability like us to transcend all the way up. I mean, heaven isn't in one place, you know, like people sometimes think of it, but it is higher vibration, much, much, much higher. So to that extent, we can call it up. I think that if if these visitors could transcend up to the glorious reality that apparently the afterlife is, according to all these not only near-death experiencers, but dead people who report back, those who have already managed to authenticate themselves by giving information, like I mentioned before, that, that neither the medium nor the sitter knows. So we figure this is a, this is an autonomous conscious agent. They talk about it as being just so glorious. It's our home. Once we get there, we realize, oh, that was just my body. That's not me. This is the real me. And we merge then with a larger self, of which we're just a splinter now talking to each other, you know? And I think it's possible that these visitors aren't on that same escalator when they die. I think that they see us transcend and they want to know how that happens. And it may be that they're harvesting souls, which is a real cheery idea. and it may be that when they abduct people, they're poking and prodding, not just for genetic material, but also for that essential spark, that soul, that they don't understand how it is that we have it. I don't know why we have it and they don't. It might be a whole separate origin consciousness that they have from what we have, and that they overlap. There's a Venn diagram and there's an overlapping area, vibrationally overlapping. But like when they take people up, people often, either they're terrified or there's another sort of cross-section of abductees who say they felt love, an unbelievable amount of love coming from these abductors. And
an elated experience, right?
Yeah. And that may just be a function of a rise in vibration. It might not be the actual intent or moral composition of the abductors. They might just be indifferent, but people feel love because their vibration is rising. They don't rise. They don't get taken by these kidnappers all the way up to the glorious vistas and gardens and loved ones and new learning potential that people talk about when they die. Instead, no, we stop in some mid zone in a like a tank or in like some metallic, some austere room, and we are subjected to these intrusions. So that's not the afterlife. I don't think if they had access to this afterlife, I don't see why they would boomerang back and forth from high to low, but never staying high, never staying low. They're just
and
going
there's
back
no
and forth.
Mention of them either, Christopher. Like, how many people have had near death experience? They never said, "Oh, I saw little gray dudes with big black eyes." It's like
I've seen that sometimes. I think sometimes there's an overlap. Yeah.
Okay. I haven't heard anything.
Streber talks about there being an overlap, but that doesn't mean that they embrace as broad a spectrum of levels of being as we do. I think if they did, they wouldn't be behaving this way. Yeah, I think, you know, sometimes there's an overlap and you can kind of say you go in my way and you can travel with them for a while. But I think that peters out at a certain point. That's just my hunch at this moment.
Man, that's awesome. Michael, do you have any final questions for our guest today?
Well, I have thoroughly enjoyed talking to you. I feel like I could talk to you about this for hours.
We've just scratched the surface, really.
Yeah, we could. I think we will talk again at some point. But my traditional final question is always book recommendations. What should our listeners and I be reading in order to understand all the interesting things that you think apply to this phenomenon and the sort of crossovers and things? It doesn't have to be about UAP, but if you could force three books into the hands of the listeners to blow their mind and help them understand the world the way you do, what would those be?
Well, just focusing on the afterlife, because otherwise it's just too vast. I would recommend Leslie Keen's Surviving Death. Many of you out there may have seen the Netflix series, but the book is much better than that, as books tend to be. Let me quickly go. Also, the book, Pim Van Lommel. He's a Dutch cardiologist, and he kind of wrote the definitive book on near-death experiences.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's called Consciousness Beyond Death. Just a second. I'm sorry.
Hopefully he's not experienced that he's just talking about his patients that he killed. They all said that they saw my shirt. Yeah.
He didn't kill them. They had cardiac arrests, and he was luckily in position to be able to interview them afterwards. And a big chunk of them had very specific experiences out of body and seeing something down the hall that they would never be able to see if they were lying there on the gurney. I wrote a book called There Is No Veil that goes through this last year. Let's see. Consciousness Beyond Life, Pim Van Lommel, last name Lommel. Another book, The Skoll Experiment, Scientific Evidence for Life After Death.
The Skoll?
S-C-O-L-E. And the author there is Solomon. And then I would recommend, well, if you can link to this, it'd be great. These are this man, Robert Bigelow, who's big in the UAP field, and he was once the owner of the Skinwalker Ranch. He sponsored a contest a couple years ago for essays that put forward the best, most conclusive evidence for survival, as it's called, survival of bodily death. And these are available on a website, and I'll email you the website right after this.
That'd be awesome.
So that you can link it below. And
just those essays, or is there a particular essay that you think?
No, they all come at it from a different angle. There's dozens and dozens of them, and they're excellent. And he was able to attract the finest minds on this subject across the world, because the winning essay got $500,000.
Wow.
And the runner ups got like $50,000. So being rich, he was able to really elicit the finest thinking that's available on this topic currently. And then
it's outsourcing, right? It's outsourcing for ideas. Yeah.
He it was a beautiful thing to do. And if you're interested in the history of the spiritualist movement, there's really one history written of it, and that's by Arthur Conan Doyle. It's called The History of Spiritualism. That's a great place to start. And then, you have, well, I could go on and on. It's going to get too pedantic. And
no, these are great recommendations. We'll put links to all the books in the show notes.
But we should also mention, guys, to please pick up Christopher's book. Of course, it's Christopher Noel. The book is called UAPs and the Afterlife, How New Disclosure Supports Centuries of Psychic and Spiritual Research. It looks like this. If you can see it on video, you'll see what it looks like. And we'll add the link for the book. And definitely help out Christopher. We always encourage everybody to obviously buy the people's books, because it helps more research to be developed. It helps the authors, and it promotes work that otherwise we wouldn't have our hands on. We wouldn't be able to.
I really appreciate you having such a wide range of guests on, people who, like, from Jacques Vallée and Richard Dolan down, people, newcomers like me, and like the Yale student that you had on today. It does a great service to the community to continue having fresh voices and updates from the heavy hitters.
Heavy hitters. And like I said, like, even, the people that, some people I don't even know yet, but I discover them, I'm like, man, it'd be great to learn from them. Like, look at what they've done. And writing things that I wouldn't be able to read or find anywhere else. It requires, teamwork to make the dream work. And the people that Michael and I get to talk to, I mean, it's just amazing. I mean, and we love every single conversation. There's not one that, there's only been two episodes in my entire time of doing podcasting that I'm like, I'm not releasing it. It's going straight to the garbage.
Oh, who were those?
I'm not naming names. I'm not naming names, but it does happen. But it only happened twice. And everybody else, like I said, have been absolute sweethearts. But it's also the love, the attention, the focus. I mean, I'm looking through your books now, just the diagrams that you got in there, the pictures, the the science behind it. That basically, when a UFO book comes out, it's not, you know, it's going to be a heavy read. You know, it's not going to be a Stephen King book. You're going to have to put some mental energy behind.
Well, some are like a page turner, but mine happens to be more dense and then like kind of cerebral, I guess is the word for it.
But I was going to say too, if you're a reader at night, a book like this is a lot better than reading Communion right before you go to bed, like I did.
It'll put you to sleep. Yeah, that's why. It's definitely better than Xanax.
You're not going to dream about alien abductions. No. It's not that scary. But no, yeah. I mean, I love books. I love the fact that you send this over to me. And I do read every book that authors do send me. I love reading. And I learn something new all the time. Even if you're a newcomer, it doesn't matter. Your knowledge, you're going to teach me something through this. You taught us both some information today that we didn't know. And unless we ask these questions to people like yourselves, we're never going to know. So this is what this podcast is all about.
We're all rowing in the same direction. So
100%.
This is a good thing. And just by the way, out there, the Kindle version is probably better. It's cheaper. So I'm recommending against my own interests. But I would recommend the Kindle version instead of the paperback. Why? Because the images don't come out very well in the paperback. And the Kindle, it's color images and it's crisp and vivid, very nice.
It's got the smell, Christopher. The smell of the pages, right? I like the physical copy. Yeah.
You can ignore me if you're a book lover. You get the physical thing. And
just don't dog ear the pages. That's all I ask. You know?
Oh, I do that all the time. It's how I conspicuously digest the book and make it mine.
Oh, you're evil.
Turn it down. I underline.
I destroy my books.
Yeah,
that's the only way to go. They're not museum pieces. They're part of my food, you know?
Well, I tag them and I highlight them, you know. Like,
oh, there you go.
I highlight some of your stuff already. But it's another page right here. But it's that's what I do, and I tag them as well. I don't mind, but the bending of the page just. I lent a book once to a friend of mine, and she gave it back to me, and it was dog-eared. Oh,
yeah.
I could have bashed her head through the wall.
You don't dog-ear other people.
Someone else's copy.
Thank you. We're not friends anymore. Just, you know, that's what happens. Awesome, Christopher. Thank you so much. We appreciate your time. I appreciate you giving us your time today. And we'll love to have you back on the podcast. If you're willing to come back on, we'll have you on any day. And
how about right now?
Let's do it right now.
You should do a fourth episode tonight.
Try to find
someone for a fifth.
Because you're a four-hour one.
Michael's not on the West Coast, so he's getting sleepy.
He's getting tired.
I've got dinner I've got to go cook. So
Nice. But no,
it's only 8:22.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, Christopher.
Thank you guys. It was a real pleasure. I like you guys. You're good. Good eggs.
I like you. Yeah. We'll have you back on sometime. See you later.
All right. I'd love to.